TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Technology and Globalization. Food for thought and food for people. I'm producing today's program in mid-October 2001 as ministers from 20 countries are meeting in Singapore to discuss the launching of a new round of the World Trade Organization. And you, who can hear this program, will have a role to play in the success or failure of future trade talks. As you remember, the huge protests in Seattle in 1999 prevented a new WTO round from going forward. These so-called rounds have traditionally expanded the central powers of the WTO, and today the U.S., supported by the European Union and a couple of G7 countries, are putting pressure on the rest of the world to go forward with the early November 2001 WTO meeting in Qatar. Lori Wallach is a trade lawyer in Ralph Nader's organization, Public Citizen. She explains how, even though the WTO round was stopped, negotiations behind the scenes were continued. Regional trade agreements, such as the proposed Free Trade Area of the Americas, set even stricter limits on our ability to demand clean food, safe workplaces, and protection for the environment. Here is Lori Wallach with a crash course on the WTO.
What we have literally is a whole system of world governance, that is corporate governance, that is imposed from the outside over all of our existing governance structures on the national, state, local levels, but even our international governance structures, like our multilateral environmental agreements or the International Labor Organization, that are international instruments of public interest rules and policies. And the instruments of this version of corporate globalization, which include the big Bretton Woods institutions, the World Trade Organization, the International Monetary Fund, and the World Bank, are very concrete instruments. They deal with ostensibly trade, finance, and investment, but do so in such an expansive way that they end up imposing a one-size-fits-all regulatory system over our environmental, social, cultural, health decisions. And the WTO is the global version of that. But one of the general points I wanted to make, and everyone knows I normally schlep around the whole WTO text, and these days I'm actually carrying around NAFTA. And the reason why is WTO covers the whole world. But NAFTA really is the high order of these instruments. This is the dream from the corporate view of how the world ought to be organized. NAFTA does more damage in the areas where WTO does damage and goes farther and deeper because the U.S. only had to fight with Mexico and Canada, not more powerful forces against them. So NAFTA I bring up because a lot of what we all face now, while fostering the existing crisis of legitimacy, but also having to make sure that there is no more regaining of momentum of the bad model, is all attempts to basically put NAFTA's missing pieces into place. So folks who worked on the multilateral agreement on investment, that was to add the missing parts that are in NAFTA that aren't in WTO to WTO. Folks who have worked against the NAFTA for Africa, the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act, or for APEC, the Asian Pacific Economic Cooperation, that's to do the NAFTA parts that aren't in WTO for those regions. Folks who now are working on, and I hope by the end everyone will be, the Free Trade Area of the Americas, NAFTA for the Americas. It's literally to expand NAFTA to 23 countries, literally. The context is really important because otherwise it seems like everyone knows about WTO now, people haven't thought about NAFTA as much, and we're now under an assault with this NAFTA for the Americas. This is the next big push that the Bush administration is going to make. These instruments like WTO constrain, actively constrain governments. Basically, it sets up parameters, and governments who sign on to these agreements agree to stay within the parameters. And it's really, in a way, because you can't imagine your elected governments would do this, it's basically like saying, hi, signing up for handcuffs, slap them right on here. I am the elected government, would like to be tied down so I can't do any of the things that the people who elected me asked me to. So we need to like realize that that's what these instruments are about. And in the context of the WTO, for instance, there are specific agreements that set up these parameters around policy in areas of food, environment, worker safety, health. It's both goods and services. So just one example. In the food standards in WTO and NAFTA, environmental protection is not a legitimate goal. This is the area where pesticide rules are set. This covers whether you can have a pesticide rule based on, like the DDT ban was, saving birds versus just does it affect humans. Environmental considerations, not a legitimate goal. All right, that's number one. Then, even if you have a legitimate goal, and that's just one example of the constraints, the means have to be within what is allowed by these instruments. And the general test is called the least trade restrictive test, the least trade restrictive test. In trade jurisprudence, what that means is the burden of proof is now on the government to show that there isn't some less trade restrictive way to obtain that WTO permitted goal, which for anyone here who's into logic means you must prove a negative. You cannot prove a negative. Therefore, you cannot meet this test because theoretically there's always some other way. It may not be technologically, economically, politically feasible, not part of the test. The burden is on the government to show it is least trade restrictive. Now, to add to this, and this is a key arguing point, if you're talking to a member of Congress or a press person or trying to get someone who's not so open-minded about these issues to think about it, these rules apply even to domestic rules that don't have any trade discrimination effect. Which is to say, the general principle of trade has always been treat your domestic stuff like you treat imports, and it's your business the level of food safety protection or the level of environmental protection. You just can't treat the imports differently, and then it's okay. It's not a trade problem. And the example of that is, for instance, the case of Europe banning beef that contains artificial growth hormones. They banned the use of the hormones in Europe so their farmers couldn't use them, and then they banned the importation of beef from other countries grown that way. Same rule, both ends. The U.S. challenged that and is an illegal trade barrier into the WTO, and they used the goals thing, the means thing, they used a variety of other stunts I'll describe in a minute, but ultimately the WTO agreed. That's an illegal trade barrier. We don't care if you're treating domestic and foreign goods the same. The fact is, you cannot ban that stuff. So, footnote, in Gatties, a domestic law that bans food with a pesticide that is known to cause cancer is a trade barrier. That's Gatties. The question is the legal or an illegal trade barrier? And then the final twist in this area of constraints is the precautionary principle. Part of how the goals that are allowable are defined is for a huge, inappropriate role of science. And that is to say, instead of science being something that may inform your policy decision, which is a subjective, value-based decision, science becomes a decision. So under the WTO and NAFTA rules, you can only make a decision once you have scientific proof there's a problem. So any measure taken in a precautionary way, like the U.S. ban on thalidomide, hello, half of our domestic regulations are based on the precautionary principle that the U.S. is out to sack in everyone else's laws, where you have to prove, the company has to prove it's safe. The government doesn't have to prove it's dangerous. Now, Europe didn't have a precautionary principle drug approval system. They allowed thalidomide, and they had the result of the birth defects. The U.S. system has precautionary principle. We didn't. That's the exact thing the U.S. attacked Europe for doing in the area of food that we already do in medicine. So precautionary principle gets sacked, science uber alles. And this also covers the area of service regulations, but not to that same draconian level. And this is what that thing, the General Agreement on Trade and Services, that people are starting to talk about and we all need to pay attention to is about. It's about taking that very strict goals and means test, the least trade restrictive rule and the legitimacy test, and applying that to all service sector regulations. Footnote, translating, out of service sector, what we mean is your doctor, your kids' schools, your water service, your local bus, all of the things that would have regulations for quality of service, public interest, price, whatever, would now be under these same means and goals tests. So those are the constraints. Item number two is new corporate rights and protections. It's not just that the government, who is supposed to put into place public interest rules, is tied up, but in fact, these instruments give corporations and investors new rights and powers that they did not have in what was already a system many could argue domestically was not exactly balanced to start with. And this is not free trade. This is managed trade. Free trade would be three pages. It would say no rules. So let's just... The two big corporate protectionisms that are worth flagging, because they make people kind of nuts when you explain this is in an alleged free trade agreement, are the intellectual property issues, TRIPS, trade-related intellectual property, TRIPS, people often call it in Gattese. And that's the, you know, that's the issue that was under the whole ACT-UP fight over South Africa access to AIDS drugs. And that is clearly, I mean, what that is practically, just to translate out, what the right is a 20-year monopoly by any company that owns a patent in any one country to have monopoly marketing rights for 20 years in all 130-plus WTO countries. It's a huge scam coming from a consumer group. I mean, hello, monopoly? Can we talk about 20 years of protected monopoly access? No surprise that then the prices go through the ceiling. That is in a free trade agreement. Go figure. Now, the good news is there's been a lot of press on these issues, and so it's a good hook for all of us to educate people about, again, the lunatic, unreasonable, unacceptable, ridiculous things that are bundled up under the happy word free trade and shoved down our throats. The second protectionist scam in here for corporations is a thing called investor-to-state dispute resolution on regulatory takings. How this has played out is that under NAFTA, companies are allowed to directly sue governments, overcoming all the protections of sovereign immunity that are typically put in place for public interest acts, and they're allowed to sue for cash compensation out of what? Out of the taxpayers' pockets, because the governments pay the companies the cash, for any government act, regulation, zoning decision, policy, that undermines these new rights, not given by God, but given by NAFTA, to them to have control over public interest demands and policies. So here's a very concrete example, and these have happened. The U.S. EPA is in the process of banning a substance called MMT. It's a gasoline additive. It's made by Ethyl Corporation in Virginia. Canada did ban it. Canada, the federal government environmental agency, said, stuff's really bad. Carcinogen, XYZ, let's get rid of it. Now, normally, that would be sort of the end of the story. I mean, the Canadian government obviously had to deal with the company petitioned, they went through the process, they offered their data, the stuff was bad, had to go. Well, that would be the end of it, except under NAFTA and these new rights, now Ethyl Corporation could go to a NAFTA tribunal, not to a Canadian court, where there's no due process, to a closed, secret NAFTA tribunal, and allege that their future profits of selling this dangerous stuff in Canada were one of those things that were protected by their new investor rights. And having had that denied, they wanted the compensation for their future lost profits, and they wanted $100+ million for all of their future lost profits. Now, you would typically say, that is ridiculous. I mean, they can't do that, right? That must have been a typo in NAFTA. Well, as a matter of fact, as the case played out, it became clear the Canadian government was going to lose. That is how extreme and unbalanced these new corporate protections are. So Canada caved in. They dumped the ban. They paid the company $11 million for the money they had lost for the period the ban had been in place. And to avoid having to pay them more, they did a statement that could be used for worldwide advertising to market this crap in the developing countries, saying the government of Canada made a mistake. It's perfectly safe. Please enjoy its use. That case happened, and there are 10 other cases like that, and I don't have time to talk about them. It is extreme, and this is what we can look forward to in the free trade area of the Americas. And the kind of things that get attacked are like zoning laws. There's another case of a company attacking a Mexican zoning regulation because they wanted to put a toxic waste dump over the main water source of a central Mexican state. And the zoning law meant that they couldn't use their property the way they wanted, so they had a loss between the current use versus what they had hoped in the future they could do, a toxic waste dump. The final issue is harmonization. Harmonization. And that is literally the push for one size fits all. In the NAFTA and the WTO, there are both requirements and incentives for all the world standards to become one single worldwide standard. As a general matter, if you have a domestic standard that is higher than any of these international standards named that you are to harmonize, and it should probably be harm-ize too, then your domestic standard is presumed to be a trade barrier. And to put this in perspective, to avoid trade challenges, Japan, just one example, just lowered 1,500 domestic pesticide standards to meet the Codex standards because A, they were required to under one of the articles of the WTO, and B, because that would avoid the challenges of countries who wanted to import things that their stronger pesticide standards didn't allow. And to put this in perspective, the pesticide standards used in the WTO and NAFTA, still, they're so weak, they're so corporate dominated, they still allow DDT residues on your grains, dairy, and meat. These are not cutting edge. Now, just to close, a key part of what we can do about all this, and the reason why I go through that nuts and bolts of the information, is to empower ourselves and other people. We need to fight the actual machine, not just the results. Thank you.
That was Lori Wallach. She's the director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, founded by Ralph Nader in 1971. She has testified before the U.S. Congress, the courts, and government agencies. Her most recent book is titled Whose Trade Organization? Corporate Globalization and the Erosion of Democracy. She was recorded at the 2001 teach-in on technology and globalization by the International Forum on Globalization. For a link to Public Citizen, go to TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Next up is Anuradha Mittal. She's the co-director at the Institute for Food and Development Policy. She has launched campaigns to challenge increasing poverty, hunger, and economic insecurity in the U.S. Born in India, Anuradha became very familiar with the so-called hunger eradication projects and their failures. She met Vandana Shiva when she was a student and became an eloquent critic of the so-called Green Revolution and today's biotechnology revolution. Anuradha Mittal.
World Bank and other international agencies are now getting in the business of promoting genetic engineering of a food and agriculture system, especially in developing countries. And they're doing so because they want to eradicate poverty and hunger. They claim that about 800 million hungry people characterize our world today, and the number is going to increase to 1.5 billion people in the next 10 years, especially in the third world. They also claim that genetic engineering is the solution by which we are going to solve the problem of world hunger. Food First, where I work, over the last 25 years, research has shown that abundance and not scarcity describes the world's food supply. Enough wheat, rice, food grains are produced to provide about 3,500 calories per day to every individual. In fact, enough food is produced to provide about 4.3 pounds of food per person per day around the world, enough to make all of us fat. So it's not a problem of production, but one of access and distribution. In fact, 72% of countries that report child malnutrition are food exporting countries. India, for example, is a country which tops the third world agricultural exporter countries. And when we talk about 800 million people not having enough food to eat, about 250 to 300 million hungry people live in India. So if we actually eradicate hunger from India, we would have alleviated the problem of global hunger, big time. At the same time, Indian government last year was saddled with 44 million tons of surplus food. While there were starvation deaths that were being reported from different parts of the country, while we have heard reports of farmers committing suicides in India, the Indian government was toying with the idea of what to do with 44 million tons of surplus food. Should it export it? Should it release it in the private market? Public distribution system that I grew up on is being abandoned, providing food to the hungry. The other reason why World Bank and others are so concerned about biotechnology and providing it to to the third world as a good doer's act is because of the benefits of vitamin A rice. Millions and millions of dollars were spent in coming up with this transgenic rice over a decade perhaps, funded largely by the Rockefeller Foundation. However, what they don't tell people is it'll take millions of dollars more and perhaps another decade before this rice can be grown in fields of farmers. UNICEF has a program in almost 70 countries where it takes from 2 to 4 cents a year to provide vitamin supplements to people who lack enough vitamin A. And of course, these agencies don't tell us what Greenpeace is telling us, according to a latest report that has been released by them, that it will take an individual to consume 9 kilograms of rice, almost like 18 to 20 pounds of rice per day, to actually make up for that vitamin A deficiency. I would love to meet the person who can eat that kind of rice per day. All this rationale is being presented by the World Bank and these life science companies as to why we need biotechnology. They don't tell us that over 1.4 billion people in this world depend upon farm-saved seeds as their primary seed source. Seed is the most important link in the food chain. Basically, whoever will control the seed will control our food supply system. Monsanto was not stupid to basically spend over $8.5 billion in acquiring seed companies. DuPont was not stupid to spend almost $9.4 billion in buying up Pioneer Hybrid, the world's largest seed company. The issue is one of control, and genetic engineering technology is delivered to communities through the seed, and therefore they have to control the seed. And that is the rationale as to why they're so gung-ho about biotechnology, and of course they don't tell us that. All these wonderful agencies who claim that they're doing it all for the starving, hungry third world, they don't tell us how Terminator and traitor technology will benefit farmers in the third world. A recent report from ActionAid actually points out that AstraZeneca and Novartis have broken commitments not to develop Terminator technology. They have also taken out 11 patents, new patents on traitor technology, which requires special chemicals to turn off and turn on traits, for example, disease resistance, fertility, flowering, sprouting. Syngenta holds 42% of the world's traitor and Terminator patents. And what do these patents do? They basically make the third world dependent on these multinational corporations for this food supply, as they have to buy seeds from these companies year after year. 80% of the food eaten in this part of the world, the germplasm of that, came from the third world. Instead of showing gratitude, what do we find? We find patent wars. A lot of people tell us, including the World Bank, which was a big promoter of green revolution in my country, India, that we do it all to increase food supply. In fact, in the 1960s, World Bank was largely responsible for urging Indian government to adopt chemical-intensive agriculture. It urged Indian government to bring in all these wonderful corporations who would manufacture fertilizers and pesticides. That's how we got a Union Carbide. And it also gave us loans so we could set up our own factories, our own plants to create chemical fertilizers and pesticides. And from 1970 to 1990, the total food available per person in the world rose by 11%, while an estimated number of hungry people came down by 16%, according to the UN. And of course, promoters of the Green Revolution say, see, you were complaining, it's because of Earth that hunger is decreasing in the world. What, again, they don't tell us is that if you eliminate China from this analysis, the number of hungry people actually increased in the world during that phase, despite increase in food production. It increased by 11%. For example, in South America, while per capita food supply rose by 8%, hunger increased by 19%, 19. This is not due to increase in population, as many of us would like to believe. This was because people did not have what he calls justice and equity. They did not have access to food-producing resources. So it's more and more obvious that it's not biotechnology or green revolution that will end hunger. It's land reform, genuine land reform, and living wage jobs that will end hunger. And And in case of China that we love to beat upon for human rights, for good reason, I want to just let people know that the number of hungry people dropped from 406 million to 189 million from, these are figures between 1970 and 1990, and that was because of land reform and broad-based changes in access to land, which improved living standards. These are the same agencies, World Bank and the others, who have told countries like India that if you want to eradicate hunger, if you want to be an industrialized country, never mind you're one of the ancient civilizations, you need to adopt export economy. You need cash crops. So you have states like Punjab or Haryana, which have been called the granaries of India. What do they grow today? They grow, you know, cattle and food, for example, Punjab, but for dogs and cats in Europe. What does Haryana do today? It competes with Kenya to actually grow tulips for Holland. So this is a situation that we are left with when it comes to these agencies. Maya Bolena, who died fighting the SS at Treblinka, said, "When the oppressors give me two choices, I always take the third." The time has come for this crowd to take the third choice. And that third choice, as far as genetic engineering goes, is pretty simple. We demand an immediate moratorium on use of genetic engineering as of now. Stop privatization of biodiversity. Leave germplasm in the public domain and appreciate the third world communities who have shared it with everyone. Free academia and regulatory agencies of corporate influence. And restrict corporate monopolies. Thank you.
That was Anuradha Mittal, co-director at the Institute for Food and Development Policy in Oakland, California. Her most recent book, America Needs Human Rights, Fighting Against Hunger and Poverty in the Richest Nation on Earth, was published in 1999. Her articles on trade, women in development, and food security have appeared in newspapers across the country, including the New York and Los Angeles Times and The Nation. I hope you have a pen handy for more information. Anuradha Mittal and Lori Wallach were recorded at the 2001 Teach-In on Technology and Globalization by the International Forum on Globalization. You can find links to the websites of the groups mentioned today on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. You can get a copy of today's program with Lori Wallach and Anuradha Mittal that includes next week's talk on television and e-commerce for $12. TUC Radio is listener-supported. Your tape order helps us continue our work. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE. For information on how to order, you can get your tape by mail or credit card, by phone, or on the web. Our toll-free phone number, 877-TUC-TAPE, translates into 877-882-8273. My name is Mariah Gelarden. Thank you for listening. We look forward to hearing from you.